Hello and welcome to the Sid Warrior podcast. The audio you're listening to has been taken from the live video podcast from my YouTube channel, Siddharth Warrior. Welcome, welcome, welcome everyone. Welcome chat. Welcome everyone. We are back on YouTube podcasting after a long time. This is episode 5.
I don't think I've ever spoken to a neuroscientist.
And I don't think I've ever spoken to a mythologist either. So the pleasure is mutual. I've heard about you forever. I think I first read your book, My Gita. And since then, I've always I've followed your articles, your the ones you've written on Midday. And then I found out that you are a fellow GM site. So you were also a student of Grant Medical College, and that to me was a very big deal.
Yeah, we both are GM sites.
Yes. Just right at the start, I was just noticing that there were all these illustrations behind you. Are all of those yours?
Yeah, they're my illustrations. So whenever I finish an illustration, I take them on my notes.
And so this is some all the stuff that you do for your books.
For my columns, I write 2 columns a week.
Right.
So I have to give illustrations for each column.
Uh-huh.
So that comes to about 100 illustrations a year. And then every book has about 50, 60 illustrations. So.
And they're all done by you. You don't outsource them to anyone.
I do some, not these illustrations. There are some other kind of technical illustrations which I outsource.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, I like to illustrate. It helps me think differently and approach things differently.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that is one thing that I learned today, that the illustrations in your book, all of them were done by you.
Yes. So it's interesting. Amazing. Every book of mine says that I'm the illustrator, but many people don't realize it.
I think everyone just starts off with the chapters and then they don't realize that you have done the illustrations.
So I have been illustrating for the last 20, 25 years.
And the switch from MBBS to mythology was a natural one. You always knew that.
I was doing, I was studying mythology when I was after internship, really, but I was doing it parallelly. So I was working in the pharma industry, and this was right. Something I used to do in my free time.
Right.
I never realized this would become so big. It was something that I did on the side. As you know, everybody has a hobby. So this was right. My hobby. Never realized. It also realized that nobody's done work on this. I mean, the kind of things that I took for granted, and I was reading academic books. And I then over time realized that academicians focus on one subject and they don't know anything about the other subject. Like I once went to a Mahabharat conference and I realized there people had never read the Ramayana. They don't read the Ramayana. One or two scholars, and those who are, they say, oh, I read the Ramayana 20 years ago. And after that, they're not in touch with it at all because that's not part of their current dissertation.
Right. So, it's amazing how this idea of super specialization exists in all fields. So nephrologists don't read neurology. It's sort of...
So that's the tragedy. And I realize that the general public doesn't want details. They right. want a more or less broad understanding of the subject.
Yeah.
And details just destroy subjects like these subjects, like mythology, etc. They don't serve any purpose also. It's just some... academic benefit.
What does that mean, sir? Details destroy the subject.
Because you go so much into a detail, it is only important to a linguist or it is important to like 100 people on earth. The general public is not interested in that. They don't want to know, like, if I talk about pottery, there are 5,000 types of pottery and each pottery ka structure kya hai. That is only an archaeologist and super specialist. Even in archaeology, there will be a super speciality group of people who will be interested in that subject, which is great for them. But they don't even invest 10% of their time trying to access the general public.
Right.
You know, I think at 90% of the time you can do your super specialization, but 10% of the time at least talk to the general public. But they can't. I see so many scholars who write books, they just can't talk to the general public.
Sir,
they just are in a little world
right.
up there.
I am resonating with this thought so much, sir, because in neurology and in neuroscience, I'm coming across the same phenomenon, because if you go into the depths of neuroscience, it is very fascinating, but not unless somebody has read up all that 15 years of medicine, they will not be able to appreciate it. So there has to be somebody who translates that into something
and
that everyone can understand.
One of the things I have always enjoyed when I, when I was in school is books that would explain things to the children. How do you explain the same subject to a child?
Right.
And you can't say, oh, no, children can't be explained. No, they can. Everybody, if you're explaining the brain to a child or mythology to a child, how do you say the same subject? So that means you have, how much do you remove in order to explain things to people? And that's an important thing to remember.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know why. For some reason, many people don't do that.
Yeah, so there is a meme going around based on this series called The Office, which is Explain It To Me Like I'm Five.
Yes. Yes.
Which, if you can do that, you have true grasp of the subject.
So, for example, I study mythology, but let's say I'm talking to a finance guy, then I want to understand economics, or I'm talking to now vaccines, for example, now virus. I want to know the virus. I want only basic knowledge. I don't want to know the molecular structure of the virus and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
I just need enough to be able to understand how it functions, what is it doing, why does it exist.
Yeah.
Just that much. And people try to become super specialists.
Yeah.
You see that what has happened to Wikipedia. Wikipedia, if you see some of the pages, they began as very basic pages to explain to children. Yeah. Now scholars and experts are writing on it, and they've all become, especially the maths and science sections of Wikipedia, are unreadable. You
Get
can't
it.
Because they are now taken over by PhD students who are completely writing for their own self-indulgence. And now I'm like, okay, the general meant to be like an Encyclopedia Britannica.
It's almost as if people want an opportunity to come and showcase what they know, and the more complex they make it, the more happy they become.
They are not interested in sharing. They are interested in showing off.
And that's a big difference.
That's the big difference. They're not interested in, and you see, so they use big words. You find that around, they talk nonsense, which have no connection with people. But it sounds, and there is a whole audience for that. Many audience likes to hear complex ideas, which not.
Yeah. So there is
a politician. It has no meaning. He tells you all complex, beautiful things, and you're like, it has no meaning to my life, but it sounds so good.
After half an hour, you feel like you've heard a lot, but you go home with nothing.
Nothing. So I've heard this. It's a tick. Many people do this. They will give these beautiful speeches at the end of which, nothing of value. You say, okay, what do I remember? Nothing. So nothing.
And that is an art in itself, sir. Of talking for half an hour and make the audience feel like they've heard a lot, but not give anything meaningful.
Yeah. So that's and also they're not interested in the audience. You're interested in your own sound of your own voice.
Right.
So it's like chana, you're eating something. You're eating, what is it called? Food without empty calories.
Right. Yeah, it's you are eating for the act of chewing, not for nutrition.
Or not for nutrition. So that's what happens. So you can go on, like many podcasts are like that. They just go on and on and on and on. And you're like, at the end of it, what did you get? Nothing.
Right. And while you're consuming it, you won't think. At that time, you feel like you're being pleasantly occupied.
So I read, listen to a lot of podcasts, but related to a book, because I don't have time to read a book. So I'll pick up the podcast and then I get a sense of what that fellow is trying to say. And that's all I want. So I receive that, but and I receive it very well because they are explaining it in a very simple way. Their books are unreadable, but in their lectures, they are explaining, okay, this is what I'm trying to communicate. And really complex subjects like evolutionary biology, which is a favorite subject of mine.
Yeah.
Again, not too much in detail. I always tell people, detail mein mat jao, because there are experts for that. And that's a world of experts, which I'm not interested in.
Yeah. It's not about zero and 100. People try to think of it in terms of binary, that either I know nothing or I should know everything.
Everything. And that's not the way it is. You just need to know enough. You know, like neuroscience excited me because, honestly, it is because I was not able to understand some people's behavior.
Hmm.
And I once went to my friend's house and I observed his dog. And we were just in the house and I'm okay with dogs. I'm not particularly fond of dogs, but I am very comfortable with dogs.
Yeah.
But my friends are very fond of dogs. In the middle of the conversation, they started playing with the dogs. So I said, what happened? Why did you break the conversation? He said, no, my dog was feeling neglected.
Wow.
He was feeling, and obviously using the dog-like expressions to get the attention of the master that you have abandoned me.
Hmm.
And I noticed this behavior in children. You know, I noticed that when I had gone for dinner and I would be talking something and the parents are very interested in me. And the child feels the parents have abandoned the child because of me. And I see the child becoming hostile, screaming, shouting. And I said, oh, the dog is behaving in this way. the child is behaving this way, and I know people who behave like this. When they don't get attention in a room, they become very hostile. Yeah. They become, and I said, oh, we are so similar. That's how dogs, and then attention-seeking behavior become. You start understanding, and then you realize that you know, when you're reading books of mythology, you have come across these characters. You come across characters who are constantly seeking attention.
Yeah.
You know, poltergeists, as we call it. The whole idea of ghosts who seek attention. So they are called poltergeists.
Yeah.
They will keep...
The mischievous ones, the ones that will keep making a mess.
And why are they making a mess? So that you notice them.
Right.
And they don't want to be left alone. There are ghosts who want to be left alone. There are ghosts who want... So in a way, we are dealing with human mind in different ways. And that's...
That's a fascinating thought, because in terms of evolution, every child actually, or rather every person actually goes through the whole of evolution in their lifetime. So if they're born, they start off as an embryo or a zygote, a unicellular organism.
And then they become the whole.
All throughout. And throughout their lifetime, they actually evolve through every stage of evolution, from fish to reptile to mammal to dog to monkey to human, as the brain grows.
Yeah, that's what people keep saying. They will say that, oh, the Hindus knew it, the avatar concept. There was the avatar.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. Because how, you know, because again, the people saying that are not interested in science.
Yeah.
They are interested in chauvinism. Huh. That, look, my culture was so great. And I'm like, no. Evolutionary thought is part of Indian thought.
Yes.
But evolutionary science is something totally different. But ab itna detail kisko interested hai? Nobody's interested.
Right. So this is, I mean, I admit, so when I was... And I was reading about biology, and when I first thought of this idea of Lord Vishnu's avatars, I admit that even I got very excited, because I thought, ki kya logic hai?
Indians are, if you look at what a shastra means, organized knowledge. So the ability to list things, classify things, prioritize things, see a pattern, this is there in Dharma Shastras, Artha Shastras, Kama Shastra. All the scriptures are organized very methodically. Mm-hmm. And there is a pattern, there is a thought. It is not a random collection of data.
Yeah.
There is, for example, even you read the Quran has chapters. Now there is a logic in which the chapters are put. They are not based in sequence.
Yeah.
They are not, the surahs are not in sequence.
Mm.
The surahs are compiled because they were oral for a long time. And they were started being written down and, you know.
Yeah.
The shorter ones, in the beginning, you'll have shorter chapters and then the longer chapters. So the logic is based on length, right? That it's not based on sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that the first chapter contains the first revelation and the second chapter contains the second revelation. So everybody comes up with their own logic to create a system.
Right.
In the Quran, the structure is of length. The length of the text decides which chapter. So the last surah is the longest. So that's how the surahs are organized. Indian Hindu texts are based on certain other parameters. Manusmriti is based on some other parameters of division. So there are chapter titles and, you know, how they're put together. So first they will talk on this, then they will talk on that. And so in the same way, when you're talking about, you'll first talk about plants, then you'll talk about animals, then you'll talk about humans. Why will you talk about plants first? Because you realize that plants can't talk or move. Why do you want to talk about animals? Because animals, so there is a logic, because human beings have logic.
Yeah.
This is not science, this is more taxonomy.
Yeah. And observation at that time.
Observation and taxonomy should not be confused with science. But it is a part of scientific thinking and logical thinking, systematic thinking. But science is about doubt and experimentation, which is not understood by most people. That science is all about, it's you are always in doubt, and the whole purpose of science is to refine. So everything that you know can be falsified, will be falsified.
Yeah.
And these are advanced level things that...
So we mentioned hunger. We talked about how that is one of the, like, a primitive response. And do you feel that, and I've heard you mention this in one of your talks, that's why I'm bringing this up, that hunger is one of the key fountainhead of religion or mythological thinking. Can I ask what you meant by that?
See, when you read Jain scriptures, they'll begin by saying, what is the difference between a living and a non-living thing? So, living organism and a non-living thing, the difference is what? Is the first question that is always asked. And now you just have to look in your room. In your room behind you, I can see there's a guitar. I can see some frames. I can see some books. I can see a plant. Now, when you leave the room and you say that I want to go away for 1 month, the only thing you have to be worried about is who's going to
Is
walk
the
in.
plant. That's true.
Right? Because that means it is alive. It needs food. What is the sign of life? The first sign of life is metabolism. And metabolism manifests through nutrition, nourishment. You will eat and you will produce and you will release excrement. So this idea of bhog, now if I use Sanskrit words like bhog, suddenly it sounds very exotic, but it basically means hunger. It's that you somebody's hungry. So when you do puja, you invite the gods and you give them food, naivedya. Which means the gods are hungry. They are living creatures. They are organic. They need food. If they don't get food, what happens to them? So these ideas, the devatas have to be fed. The ancestors have to be fed. So pinda is given. Tarpana is given. All these ideas are about food. And then you realize the scriptures are sensitive about food. The child wants food. When you die, you stop asking for food. Dead body won't ask for food. Now, food is, of course, then becomes a complex metaphor. It's not. It becomes prana. So it is breath. So search for breath. So these are, depending on which animal level you're talking about, microorganisms, whether you're plant, whether you're talking about animals, it becomes more and more complex. But what is important is food. And therefore, the Upanishads keep talking about how the whole world is made of food. They're trying to understand the universe. And they're saying the universe. And they start asking that in the first living creature, was hungry, did food pre-exist? Or, you know, what? So the you know, sunlight existed before organic life, right? And then plants appear and turn sunlight in through chlorophyll produce food. So food or matter existed before, which is converted into food by a living organism. So this logic, and you don't need science for this, it's just
Yeah. So when we say food, can we think of energy?
Energy does not mean food. Please understand, because even if there was no living organism on Earth, there is still sunlight, which is energy.
Correct. There is still energy.
So, in order for energy to become food, you need an entity.
Yeah. You
No,
need
so
life.
you need a life. So, energy is always there, but life is not always there.
Yeah.
And
Wow.
life, and therefore, when people use words like energy, you know, I keep saying that, yes, a matter is energy. This is always going to be there. It's never not going to be there. The question is, when does a conscious thing come along saying that, no, I am pursuing this energy to produce food? And I use the word plant because plant can be seen. We can't see micro. We know that there were microorganisms before. But plant is what I can see. It is the plant that converts the sun into food.
That's
If
a
there were no plant, there would be no animal, there would be no humans. We need the plant to convert sunlight into food. In the absence of plants, no animal can survive, and therefore no human can survive.
Yeah.
And therefore, plants are vital. So, you know, so we know, for example, there were microorganisms before which used to use carbon dioxide. Then they started producing oxygen as an excrement. Then later, you know, they're anaerobic and aerobic and all those things. But broadly, a jiva appeared which turned energy into food. Food, energy always existed.
Yeah. It's almost like the observer effect that we talk in quantum physics, that you need an observer to convert. If without an observer, it's just energy, but with an observer, energy becomes food.
Yes. So therefore, the observer always has an observation.
Yes.
So you can't separate the observer and the observation, because the moment there's an observer, he's seeing something.
Yeah.
So there's food. So the moment there's hunger, there is food. But if there was no hunger, was there food? No, there was energy. It is hunger that creates food. If there was no hunger, there would be energy, yes, but nothing else.
Yeah, but nobody would want it because that want itself is
Want is hunger. Na?
Want is hunger.
Buddha is saying desire is the cause of suffering. Now, Buddha never used the word desire. That's an English translation. The word he uses in Pali is tanna. Tanna means thirst.
Okay.
So he is not using, because remember, he is talking to a farmers in those days, farmers and herdsmen.
Right.
Not talking to, so he is explaining to people, jaisa tumko pyaas lagta hai, jab pyaas lagta hai, to tumko takleef hoti hai. Agar tum if you never felt thirsty, you wouldn't suffer.
Right.
So now, if I take away hunger from your life, you have no ambition, no desire, nothing. You will be happy. Will you be happy? The question is. Now that's where the discord starts. Because if I have no hunger, that means I have no purpose.
Yeah.
And I will be like a rock. A rock has no hunger. It is, that's why Shivji, when he does meditation, they will, the goddess says, "Tum patthar ke devata." That's why we put water on a shivling to remind us that it's useless on that rock. But if you put it under a tree, the tree grows. In a Shiva temple, you'll always see water dripping on a rock.
Right.
And remind you that that rock has no, it needs to be Jagrit. So what does Jagrit mean when they say Prana Pratishtha? These are all Sanskrit words, but it basically means if you don't experience hunger, you cannot contribute to life.
Beautiful.
So that is the primary, and now people are realizing that when you're studying consciousness, you have to begin with the basics. The basic, every unicellular organism has hunger. So consciousness is not top down, it is bottom up.
Bottom up. It's an emergent property of...
Emergent property. It's not a some divya thing has come from... I mean, of course, we can always think that because then otherwise Guruji's will go out of business.
No, Guruji is a top-down process, but consciousness is bottom.
It meant, you know, Gurujis are like queen bees. There are bees in this world looking for a queen bee. And they want to be part of a hive. We call them ashram. So ashram, chale jate hain, and it's a beehive. And they make madhu. It's very nice.
Yeah.
A lot of honey which is produced over there, and everybody's happy. The queen bee, the bee, everybody's happy. So it's cool. It's a good place for them.
What I really loved about this discussion so far is this realization that whatever it is that we want already exists in the world. It is just that we have to want it for that thing to become a purpose. Otherwise, it is purposeless.
So that's what we call, you know, nowadays new age people will say, I manifested.
Ah, right. The law of attraction.
Sunlight is always there. So now when the green leaf comes, say, I've manifested food.
I love it.
I mean, you know, so theek hai. I manifested it. It was always around you. So it's...
Exactly. So this is very, very similar to that book, The Secret, or the idea that if you want something, the universe conspires to make it happen.
It's basically a lazy book, right? You don't have to do anything. You just have to, you just have to desire. Arey, chlorophyll bhi chahiye na. Without chlorophyll, that energy cannot turn into food nuggets. So you see the success of the book Secret. Basically, lazy people. It is basically saying, kuch nahi karne ka tere life mein.
You have to want.
College, school, nahi. See, when you say, a child goes to school, it bursts into tears and crying. You think of all those maths lessons, beaten up by parents, tuition teachers, abuse, humiliation. We go through to go through education. And somebody comes along and says, no.
Just want.
And I'm like, what a selling strategy it is. But if you read carefully in the book introduction, they'll say it is one of the secrets.
Yeah.
Cleverly.
Their lawyer made them write that.
Because they have got, because I'm manifesting. And I'm like, very nice here. Buddha went all his life saying that desire is the cause of suffering.
Yeah.
And come up with the thesis that no, desire is...
Is the secret to life.
That is how life is. But ultimately it comes down to desire. Because life is about hunger.
Yeah.
All plants, all animals, all human beings, everybody you see. I mean, in management, we don't use the word hunger. We call it ambition.
Yeah.
So we'll say think big.
Hmm.
Basically, you know, be hungry, be hungry, be hungry, be hungry.
Yeah.
You know,
what is that book? Stay hungry, stay fresh. Something like that. Yeah.
Stay hungry, stay foolish.
Stay foolish, yeah.
And this whole idea that forever you should be hungry is what an unhappy life. That means you'll never be tripped. That means it's, you know, in the mythology, these are called pretas, the ghosts.
Wow.
Who are always hungry because, and they can never be satisfied because they don't have a body. Because they don't have a body, they don't have a stomach. Yeah. Because they don't have a stomach, no matter how much food you give them, there is nowhere to hold it. And therefore, they're always hungry. You know, 24/7. And in Ramayana, there is this asura called Kabanda. His whole face and his body, his head and his stomach have become one. Because he's only eating all the time and he's never being satisfied. He just can't be satisfied. And that is the state of life where it is Kabandha. He's a monster who is constantly eating and never can burp himself. He's never going to be satisfied.
So this constant sense of fear of FOMO that a lot of people feel now.
Because I want more and more and more and more. And I'm like, it'll never end because of trupta. That, you know, when you eat food, you burp.
Yeah.
And you feel happy. And for at least a few hours, you're fine.
Yeah.
That state will never be. You will never be in that state, which is such a horrible place to be in. It's the worst hell. Naraka ka last part is where the pretas are living and they're screaming, hungry ghosts. In Chinese mythology also, it's become, from Buddhism, it's spread to China.
Yeah.
And they call it pretas, the hungry ghosts.
Wow.
So, the, you know, the sad, hungry, wailing ghosts, constantly crying, yearning, begging, and wants, and that is what capitalism is based on.
I was just going to ask that. Do you think this is a comment on not the dead but the living, the everyday life?
Them everywhere. You see, you go to schools and colleges. Everybody is that yearn. You know, there is that bird which is constantly yearning.
Give
me to come and give me a worm in my, and they're so yelling. So that is the how the world is imagined.
Yeah.
You see people screaming, shouting, begging, yearning, you know, always wanting something. And Buddha is aware of that. He's saying, this is what life has become. And of course, when he comes to Madhyama, he's like, okay, this is... So this was the India's greatest revelation. They said everything revolves around hunger. And in mythology, that becomes the most... So in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishads, Brahma, when he's talking, he will say, it begins by Brahma experienced loneliness. So he, and therefore, because he was lonely, he created the other, manifested.
Yeah, Saraswati.
So the other.
The other.
Use much later.
Okay.
Just that he creates the other.
Mm.
So all creatures in the world exist because you are lonely, because you are hungry, because you are, so if your loneliness is hunger.
Yeah.
So we are constantly seeking the other. And that's what you want food, you want everything that you want will be satisfied with something around you.
Yeah, you will find it. So that,
through the hunger of Brahma.
Isn't it ironic that you meet the love of your life in the very classroom that you go to? What are the odds of 7 billion people?
Rooms full of pretatmas looking at which is the best morsel to eat. Both of them decide, oh, I can eat you and you can eat me. How exciting. I'm sorry, it sounded vulgar.
but that's what ghosts do.
You know, so that's what life is all about. We're looking for people who can feed each other. And that's what life is. So
and that's every love story in a nutshell.
Relationships. Why do you have relationships?
Right.
We call the gods in the yajna to feed them. And the gods feed us. So there is, yajna is about dehi ma dadami te. Give me what I give you. This is the basis of human relationships. Fairness. I give you, therefore you give me. And this is why humans exchange. We have, any society, anywhere in the world, you know, when I meet, I am looking for a friendship. Why do I go traveling? Because I want to consume the experience of traveling.
Right.
So we are constantly consuming. Conversation. We consume conversation.
Give and take. The story of humanity is an exchange offer.
Is always an exchange.
Basically.
And the whole idea that, you know, all our life you're doing that. You're watching Netflix and chill. You're consuming.
Yeah.
You're eating food. You need companionship. You need shelter. You need clothing. Look at what COVID has done. We are all locked. We are yearning. We have been locked in. We have been denied. Our hunger for freedom.
Yeah.
Like, why do we want money? Because money gives us the ability to feed ourselves in different ways.
Right. Right.
You know, it's indulgence and the food, travel, clothes, friends.
Yeah. So with all this hunger, there, it is only natural that it is associated with fear. Because we want so much, we are always afraid that what will happen if we don't get yes. something.
Fear is of two types. One is the fear of not getting, of not being satisfied, not
yes.
being indulged, of being deprived of food. The greater fear is of becoming food. Because remember, the tree is producing, but the tree does not want to be eaten by the goat or the sheep or the cow. It produces thorns. It produces thorns to protect. So the same way we also protect things to, we don't want someone to exploit us. We don't want someone to take advantage. What is the worst feeling? All those TikTok songs and those real songs, bewafa, mujhe dil tod ke chali gayi. Basically, she abused me and went away, or he abused me and went away. He ate me and did not feed me. And this conversation is a betrayal. In relationships, you feel people falling apart because you feel you are only providing, nobody's providing you, and therefore you feel exploited.
Right.
And that is the worst. So we are terrified of being exploited. We don't want to be eaten. So, you know, when the Sanskrit words, they will use like jivo jivatsya jivanam, life feeds on life. And it means that no life wants to be, no, we don't want to be eaten. No, we don't want to go and say, okay, eat me. Although there'll be the great kings who will shibi raja, who will give you a body to eat.
Yeah.
But these are all magical stories because nobody's going to do that. They're never going to do that.
Yeah.
I don't want you at, in humans, it is metaphorical. I don't want you to exploit me. I want to be treated fairly. I want you to feed me and I will feed you. This is a fair exchange.
So I have a interesting question. Do you think that because everybody wants fairness, but everybody will not get fairness, there will always be some people who will be abused. Do you think this idea that there will be fairness given to you after death sort of equalizes the story?
That's a rebirth, right? Rebirth is because you're a hungry ghost. FOMO, fear of missing out. All the pitras are missing out on life. So they want to come back to life. That's why the Shraddha is done, because you're promising the pitras that they will come back to life again. And this idea is an Indian idea, because see, our entire thesis, it comes from food. The entire Indian thought comes from food. It is not in Western thinking.
Right.
When you are reading the Bible, when you're reading the Genesis, it doesn't begin with food at all. In fact, the act of eating food results in you being kicked out of Eden.
Oh, wow. That's true.
This idea of obedience is at the heart of Western thought.
Right.
Not indulgence.
Hmm.
Indian thought revolves around indulgence. Mereko bhook laga hai. While in the West, bhook is temptation.
It's a negative connotation.
It's a negative connotation. To be hungry, to be wanting, to desire is a negative act. It is not a cause of suffering. It is like God is, you just do what God has told you to do. Now that's it. So this whole idea of God, God creates the world, God gives rules and you will follow. So the beginning of Western thought is God. Not you, God. Indian thought, it is aham, me. So it begins with the individual. There, it doesn't begin with a transcendental entity, which is there in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Right, the Abrahamic.
Abrahamic faiths. Now the word Abrahamic is only recent, 10 year old, huh, by the way.
Oh, really?
Nobody used this word 10 years ago. It starts with the Gulf War. Only after the Gulf War did Christians acknowledge that Islam and Christianity have a common root. Please remember, they've been killing each other for almost 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So there is no way the Christians, say 100 years ago, accepted that they, the Christians and the Muslims have always hated each other. Because remember, in Christianity, sex is the original sin. While in Islam, this is not so. In Islam, God helps Adam and Eve learn the art of being married. So the angels come down and decorate them and help them get married, and therefore explains pleasure. So pleasure is God's gift to mankind, and therefore the Muslims always enjoyed pleasure, which is what the Christians hated.
Right.
The Wahhabis also don't like this idea, by the way. But in general, is the notion of paradise, Jannat, in Islam is full of pleasure. So it is fountains, it is gardens, fountains. You know, we heard the story of the 72 virgins. Well, we can basically beautiful things, beautiful food, beautiful life. Christianity, the heaven is not like that. Christianity, heaven is peace and tranquil, and a man with a harp.
In devotion to God. So it is.
Because Christianity emerged, not even more than devotion. Remember, Christianity emerged against the backdrop of Roman debauchery. So Romans, you know, when you read when you see the Asterix comics, they will show all the Romans having orgies and they're enjoying themselves. Of course, they'll always show them eating a lot of food, which is a metaphor for sex. So food, sex, pleasure. So the Christianity hated this, and they said, this is bad, this is evil, this is devil. So any form of enjoyment of life is bad. So Christians come from that point of view. Islam comes from the point of view that life is about pleasure. So there is the beautiful art, music, but in a very controlled ecosystem. You cannot create, for example, they would not create it human forms. You know, they would not like human forms being created. So, and the puritanical Arabs were more puritanical, and the Persians were not puritanical. They therefore enjoyed life, they enjoyed pleasure. And they saw Jannat as a manifestation of extreme luxury.
Right.
So the Muslims, as far as Christians were concerned, Muslims were devil worshippers, because they loved luxury and they loved pleasure. Anybody who loves pleasure is devil.
Yeah.
So when the Christians came to India, they thought Indians were all devil worshippers. A, you worship idols, then you seem to be enjoying song, dance, enjoying good food. This is all signs of the devil.
Is it because of the backdrop against which they come? Because Islam, I think, came at from a time where it was, it didn't come from luxury. It didn't come against the backdrop of luxury.
It did. You see, the problem is when we think of Islam, most Indians, unfortunately, are thinking Arab countries, which are dead, arid lands with nothing there, and dead Bedouins. And when you go to Dubai and all that, you just see dead, everything is dead. And now, of course, air-conditioned malls. But really, the Islamic world is Persia.
Right.
Islamic world is Iran. And unfortunately, Iran is now covered with this Ayatollah, with black clothes and covering. But Iran is about the Achaemenid dynasty. It's about Persia. It is about luxury of a different level. The Ottoman Empire, the Safavid Empire, the Mughal Empire. These were painting, music, dance,
art.
It was in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, the Abbasid, the Brocade, the Baghdad, when you talk about Arabian Nights, this is what the Mongols came and destroyed Baghdad completely, but they brought a new way of thinking. Because after the Mongols attack, which completely wiped out the old Abbasids, you have the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is all about luxury. I mean, Ottomans are only about luxury.
Yeah.
Remember, the Europeans saw them as debauched people who only loved brocades and silks and gowns. Only thing is, they used to keep women segregated, because they used to keep men and women were segregated even in pre-Islamic times.
Right.
The entire Middle East always segregated women. It was nothing to do with Islam. It was always segregation of women. It's therefore the ghungat practice in India comes to us from Scythians. And Scythians, who are Central Asians, what is called Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, these areas, even before Islam, the women used to be covered. So the ghungat which comes to India, in North India, is a pre-Islamic practice. It is not an Islamic practice per se. Islam adopts it. But it's a pre-Islamic practice. The idea, because also it's a hot country, maybe everybody covered their bodies and face, but women were always kept segregated. It was not that women were... So there are those differences that you see.
So then whenever I think about linguistics and religion, these two topics, I get very interested in how culture flows from place to place. And it's like this living organism that sort of constantly evolves across through geography and across through time.
See, human mind, see, you study the human mind, right? And we are living, the same brain is located in a desert. The same brain is located in the forest. The same brain, no other animal can do this. All other animals adapt through their bodies.
Yep.
We adapt with our mind. We create a culture bubble.
Stories.
A culture bubble. For a simple thing that we create technology. We create air conditioning.
Yeah.
We create technology. So culture is not just an intellectual space. It is also a material space.
Yeah.
So the Bedouin culture emerges, which uses camels, which uses wool, which uses the oasis and the resources available to the Bedouins in the Arab, in the forest.
Yeah.
So the Arab cultures have stories which are related to that climate.
Mm.
Indian stories are related to monsoon.
Mm.
You know, stories from Kerala. You're from Kerala. There is something called Aitihamala, which comes, which they'll only talk of the coconuts and they will talk of the lagoons and they'll talk of the people in Kerala. They will not, it will have no resonance to people in Odisha, because Odisha will have a very different storytelling tradition.
Right.
The ecosystem is different. Rajasthan will have a different ecosystem. Kashmir will have a different ecosystem. The human mind will look at the geography, the climate, the weather, and then first create technology and stories to suit its need.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there is migration patterns happening. So new ideas are coming.
We'll keep exchanging. And the stories and the technology are not independent. They are weaved together to create a bubble that is unique to that place that helps those people survive.
I'll give you an example. If you go to Bangladesh, and you know, nowadays what happened, unfortunately, in Bangladesh is we always talk of Hindu Reformation. Mm-hmm. You don't talk of the Muslim Reformation. Young men from India went to Europe and America. Muslim men also went, and they came back saying the real Islam is Arabic. And they therefore denied the local Indian Muslim traditions. So Bengal had a very unique tradition of fakirs and of babas. And these are this Ghazi Mia. There's Ghazi Mia, Bade Ghazi Mia. It's a very vague term. It doesn't mean a person. It is a vague term of people, of these peers who lived in the Sundarbans, who walked, who used to travel on crocodiles, who used to travel on tigers. In their hands, they used to hold snakes. Now, when you look at an image, a man is riding a tiger, which is floating on top of a crocodile and holding a snake in his hand. It almost looks like a Hindu god, but they'll say, "Wo Makkah se aaya tha."
Okay.
And he came from Makkah and he stayed here. So now you're seeing Islamic idea, Mecca, flying carpet. In fact, if you go to Bangladesh, the airport in Dhaka is called Shah Jalal Airport. And he's supposed to have come from Mecca on a flying carpet to Bangladesh. So therefore, airport is named after him. And he lives in that area. And the stories of images are always about crocodiles and the crocodiles and tigers and snakes, which are there in Sundarban. So now the local ecosystem has provided me with the motif. Yeah. Now, this is not there in Quran. Right. Because Quran, there are no crocodiles. There are no tigers. And there are no... The snake is there because it is part of the snake.
That geography.
That geography.
Right.
So geography makes a difference.
Yeah.
And that is what people don't understand. When we read the Quranic text, we are reading about something which is written in Arab countries. And even Arab is lots of diversity. In Arab countries, there's coastal Arabia, where the monsoon was there and there was agriculture to some extent and trade. And then there is the Bedouins, which are the real Arabs.
Mm.
The real Arabs are the ones who live up from the desert, the Bedouins. And Muhammad's mother was born in a family which was coastal, but was his foster mother was a Bedouin. And that, why is that story of foster mother important? The foster mother gives him legitimacy. So now it is saying that he has been raised by the two sides of the Arab. The trading, the trader Arabs as well as the Bedouin Arabs.
Wow.
So you see this history, geography, storytelling, all mingle and merge.
Yeah.
The mind, the human brain, and that is what is exciting. We should always understand the human brain has not evolved in the last 100,000 years. It is it. That's it. We just keep making and breaking connections.
Yeah.
But your brain size, my brain size, and 1,000 years ago,
it's the same.
Even our Stone Age ancestors is exactly the same, which means they are responding to their ecosystem and creating, they have the same technology as you and me. The same physiology, the same neurology.
Correct.
So they are no different from you and us. It's just that we have got more information.
We have access to more information.
We have access to a lot more information than they did. They had qualitatively different. That doesn't mean that you and I can fight a wild animal using rocks. That skill is gone. We don't know it. We know theoretically rocks can be used to kill an animal, but we don't have that skill anymore. Yeah. That skill has gone. But the knowledge and information is still there with us.
Yeah. So when we look at somebody, say, in Alaska, and we say that, okay, they are living in an igloo. They're living in a snow house or an ice house. We don't judge them. We accept that they have used technology available to them to live in that kind of environment. But somehow we don't apply that same concept to the stories that they have. We Yes. expect that they will abide by the same stories that we grew up with, that they will have the same God, they'll have the same belief systems, which is false because technology and stories go hand in hand.
And this is what monotheism brings to the table. See, this is a phenomena which began in the 3rd century in Rome. Rome was the first place in the world where the king said, only my God shall be worshipped by all and every other God shall be destroyed. Previously, what they would do is that my God shall be worshipped, but your God shall also be worshipped. But Roman emperor made a rule that only my God shall be worshipped and no other God shall be worshipped.
Constantine.
Constantine does that in the 3rd century. He does that. And this inspires the faith. And if you look at it, what is Islamic line? There shall be no... The Shahada is there is only one God and no other God but God.
Yeah.
This almost sounds like what Constantine would say.
Yeah.
And are we saying there is no correlation? Because there was nobody thought like that before.
Mm.
The Zoroastrians did have one God, but they never said others should not be worshipped.
Mm.
The Jews had their own one God. They said, we will worship one God. You can worship whoever you want.
Right.
The Zoroastrians would say everybody will have their own gods. The Romans had no problem with this. They said, you will worship the emperor. If you worship the emperor, it's fine. So then you can do whatever you want.
Right.
You see, this is what, but when Christianity comes in, and more importantly, political Christianity in the form of Constantine, the world changes dramatically. He says, only Christ shall be worshipped, nobody else. And Christ is God, Holy Trinity, blah, blah, blah. And this 3rd century phenomena changes us forever. Religion
right.
becomes a political force.
Yeah.
And then Islam comes in, and in Islam says, okay, only my God is the true God and no other God is false. And even today, that's exactly what Hindutva will do. And we are seeing this legacy of the Romans being carried forward, where my truth is the truth. And as you said, they live with igloos. The igloo ka God will be different. Now they worship Sedna. Sedna is the goddess of the sea, and who creates all the animals. For them, the gods are seals and walruses and whales.
Yeah.
It's a different world. And now we know, we'll say, are hum log ka kahan hai seals, walruses and whales.
Sir, at some point, at some level, I understand why someone would want that. Like if it was Constantine, there is a lot of comfort in uniformity.
Yes.
When you look at chaos, you get, you feel uncomfortable. And if you are somebody who feels like I want to control this, the first thing you do is you make rules and you say that everybody do like this and everybody will be happy. And you feel like you are doing it for their own good.
And that is where the human mind looks at its hunger as the most important hunger and does not recognize that other people have hungers which are different from theirs.
Right.
This is empathy. Where I am so obsessed with my hunger that I believe my hunger is everybody's hunger. If I solve my hungry problem, everybody's hunger is solved.
Right.
And I see that all the time around us. We don't realize that, you know, your food is not the same as other people's food. You know, everybody
exactly.
lives in a different ecosystem.
Yeah.
And therefore, everybody will look at the world very differently, eat differently, sleep differently, you know. And that is the best thing that Indian thought has brought to the table. We never liked uniformity. We have always liked diversity, customization, shifting ideas. This is the great Indian contribution to the world, is we uniformity is, and the negative point of that is that we don't have systems. Therefore, everybody says India is chaotic, but India is not chaotic. It is multiple superimposing negotiating systems coexisting together. There is always a system. It is just that you are not in control and therefore you hate it.
Yeah. So to say something is chaotic, we are brought up thinking that chaos is a bad thing. And if you say that, oh, this is chaos, it is almost like you're insulting it. But isn't chaos the way of the universe? And to say that it is not chaotic at some level sounds like denial to me.
See, chaos is a Greek concept. It is not a Hindu concept at all. There is no word for chaos in Hinduism. Prakriti is the word, nature. In the beginning, there was prakriti. Prakriti is never seen as chaotic. The idea of chaos comes only in Greek myths, and therefore you see the gods, or you see in Mesopotamia, where Tiamat is conquered by Marduk. The gods of chaos, the god defeats, the chaos comes. The idea of this knight defeating the monster is a Greek idea, is a Mesopotamian.
Chaos being the monster and...
The monster. Oh. This is not an Indian thought at all. This idea of defeating chaos and creating order is a very Greek way of thinking. It's a Greek pattern.
Right.
Indian thought is, in the beginning, there is nature. So, prakriti, and then humans come along, Purusha, and then creates culture, which is Sanskriti. Now, if you ask me, where is order? Is there order in Purusha, in Prakriti, or in Sanskriti? We say all three orders exist. It's the Prakriti's order is not answerable to Purusha.
Yeah.
Sanskriti's order is answerable to Purusha. That is, so Indian map thinking, the word chaos doesn't exist. The only, the word is Arajakta, which is the absence of a king. Nobody will respect rules of Sanskriti.
Okay.
So you'll return to Prakriti. So nature's world, it's not chaotic. It's just natural world.
Right.
So the Indian thought does not have the concept of chaos at all. It is not there. It's all patterns.
I have a fundamental problem with the concept of chaos itself, because it is very observer dependent.
Yes. So a foolish person, look at an Excel sheet with lots of numbers.
Yeah.
Will say, oh, it's all chaotic. A smart guy looks at it and can see patterns.
Exactly.
And immediately will see a pattern within it. So how smart you are will create a pattern.
Yeah.
So, but the Western thought is based on chaos and control, chaos and control, chaos and control. So naturally politicians, look at how Indian politicians will say, before I came, there was chaos. When I came, there is order. So this is ego at work, ahankara. When I come, there's order. Without me, there is no order. Indians thought, that is what Daksha Prajapati is saying, that I am order. Whatever I do is order. And Shiva comes and cuts his head off. Says, you foolish fellow, aisa nahi hota hai life mein. There is always order. It is just that that order is not answerable to you, and therefore you don't like it, because it makes you feel small.
Yeah. There is always chaos. There is always order. These two things have always existed together.
There is no chaos.
There is no chaos.
Perception of chaos by the unenlightened mind.
Beautiful.
So that is the Indian approach. The word chaos is not an Indian idea at all. And so when I hear a scholar using the word chaos, I'm like, so nahi India samajh mein nahi aaya.
Wow. Brilliant. Really,
I see all these, like, one of the columnists recently wrote about how Indians don't follow protocol, we don't follow systems. Like, देखो इंडिया समझ में नहीं आया. India is not homogeneous. The whole thing about India is it is not homogeneous. That is what makes India, India is heterogeneous. It hates homogeneity. It will never be monotheistic.
Yeah.
So grow up.
This is a difficult conversation to have against the backdrop of a pandemic where we need 1 billion people to behave in a systematic way. But
we really don't need 1 billion people to live. We just need 30% to be vaccinated. That's it. That's all it needs. 30 to 40%, and especially in crowded clustered areas.
Yeah.
And that's all we need. And that part of India is adequately domesticated.
That will happen.
So, the question is, we have made a mess of the supply chain. That's all.
Yeah.
Hopefully in 3-4 weeks, the supply chain issues will be resolved. But we will lose 3-4 weeks. So we will have 3-4 weeks of difficult times. But then... we'll catch up, and we will do it our messy way. India is going to be messy. India, Bombay is the only place in the world where there is a bridge which is supposed to go across the bay and then takes a right turn. And that is India. That is what we do. And we genuinely believe that, you know, if you have white beard and you wear orange clothes, you're celibate. No logical explanation. I keep saying this is not scientifically proven, that if you have long beard and you have orange clothes, you are celibate. Because there is no scientific test in the world to prove that you are celibate. I cannot. You can't do a test. I can test for COVID. I can't test for celibacy. So, but we believe it. So, we can't. India is like
this. It is all about the storytelling, sir. That the, when the story is strong enough and the power and repeated enough, then people will go into pattern recognition. Ki ye pick up ho gaya. And it's easier to pick up small cues and draw out the rest of the story rather than actually finding out the rest of the story.
See, ask yourself, who gave you the word chaos?
Hmm.
As a child, at some time, somebody introduced the word chaos into your vocabulary. Yeah. And therefore, you started seeing chaos.
Yeah.
Language created the world for you. So, yeah. Bhasha, and if you read philosophy, it's language which creates. A language has created the divide between work and life.
Yeah.
If the you had not been given these two words, work and life, or weekday and weekend, you would not have created these concepts. You would have experienced them very differently.
Yeah.
Right? So now the people who live in the desert have many words for sand. Mm. Those who live in the in the Arctic region,
yeah,
will have many words for snow. You know, same way India has many words for desire, and we have different words for spices.
Yeah.
So everywhere, whatever is the, our words create our worlds. So
there is so much of a role that our imagination plays, our creativity plays, in coming to terms with this hunger and this fear. So whenever we are faced with a situation that we cannot really explain, we rush to our creativity. And I am amazed at what all we can come up with to explain pretty much anything.
So it's called rationalization. So the human mind will, for example, you are hungry and you're not getting food. How do you reconcile yourself? The animal will keep looking for food. If it doesn't get food, it will starve and die.
Yeah.
But humans are not happy with that situation. Now we will create a story to explain our starvation.
Yeah.
And say, we must have done something wrong in our life and therefore God is punishing us. Now we created a story.
Yeah.
Or there is a devil out there which wants to kill us and one day a hero will come and rescue us.
Yeah.
Or in this life, if we die of starvation, in our next life, we will be born in abundance.
Yeah.
So we create stories to, you know, dil ko samjhane ke liye, behlane ke.
What is that? Gale bhi ek khayal achha hai.
So that is the whole idea. We create stories to delude ourselves.
Yeah.
And without that, we will go mad because our brain is so, unlike an animal's brain, you know, we see so much more. We can't handle it. We'll go mad.
Yeah.
And therefore, we need stories to structure it. Therefore, human brain evolved, although it evolved 1,000 years ago, it took a very long time before we have no feathers, we have no claws, we have no, and yet we had to survive. We had to survive only using our mind and our brain. It would have been terrifying in the early days, and gradually we became primary predators very soon.
Yeah.
We used our ability to use, we became major predators. We were one of the most powerful predators in the world using rocks.
Yeah.
Just using rocks, that's all we did. We controlled fire, we controlled stone, but it took thousands of years. Today, we are seeing technology changing very rapidly. But in the early stage of human evolution, technology took a very long time. Farming only began 10,000 years ago.
Mm.
Industrial revolution took place 200 years ago.
Yep.
So these are very slow processes, and now we are going very rapidly, but we have not yet resolved the issue of hunger, right? We are still hungry. Bill Gates is still hungry. He's still trying to protect patents.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. He tells you, itna paisa hone ke baad bhi itna ungenerous aadmi abhi bhi bhooka hai, pretatma ke jaise. So he's still hungry.
Still hungry. We are still afraid.
And still afraid. Ki kya ho jayega dunia ko dene se kuch. Usko itna takleef ho raha hai. She tells you the richest man in the world who is supposed to be charitable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful, no? He has revealed it so beautifully that the richest man in the world who claims to be charitable is afraid of giving patents. When the world is in the middle of a crisis.
That proves that everybody has the same brain, the same amygdala in the limbic system is overactive in everyone.
Everyone. So he is no different with all the money in the world, so much money.
Hmm.
He's still as stupid as you and me, and that's a great relief.
And the wonderful thing is that in his mind, he will create his own story.
Of course.
Justifying why he is the good person.
And he'll have an entire PR department will try to convince you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Indians are over smart, and we know that doesn't work like that because we are better storytellers. We will fool ourselves before you can fool us.
So today, like you said, technology has advanced so rapidly, and we now have, like we said, this amalgamation of stories and technology. Now, because technology is making us so comfortable, and because more importantly, same technology exists everywhere, in China, in the US, everywhere. So now we have a lot more in common. And so our stories are also starting to become similar across different countries.
Humans will never homogenize. It is the nature of consciousness not to homogenize. We will always reject homogeneity. That's why children rebel against parents. It's the nature of the beast. It is that I will not be you because I lose my identity.
Yeah.
No matter, that's why parents and children are always going to be at loggerheads.
Yeah.
Because the parent will impose a structure on the child will reject it. And that is happening around the world. Why does Brexit happen? Why does MAGA happen? Why does Hindutva happen?
Yeah.
It is all expressions of, I will not align. I will not become like you. So all the China will create its firewall and say that I will not do.
Right.
And Europe will always say that I will love you so long as you accept the right people are superior.
Right.
This is not going to change. If you think the white people are going to become less racist, it's foolish. It's not going to happen. It's like women think that men are not going to be patriarchal. And women will be feminist. This will be a part of life. There'll always be people who will be nasty. The proportions will keep changing. The proportions will keep changing. We are definitely not as violent as we were 100 years ago. We're definitely more peace, but pockets of violence are there.
Yeah.
But generally, we are living much more peaceful lives. If you were living in a hunter-gatherer society, every few weeks, somebody would come and broken your head.
Yeah.
You would have cut your head off and you would have had hunters. We have not seen that in our lives. We have seen riots on our television screen. We are living in a... So we really are living technologically better lives, but not emotionally.
But
better.
Not emotional. So the reason we don't homogenize is because whoever is in the hierarchy of power structure wants to keep that power structure. Like, men will want to keep patriarchy alive because traditionally they have more power than women. White people will want to keep power over others.
We all do. It's not about you and I will also not like to give up our power.
Right, right.
Why would I give up my identity for your sake? It is like, I will not eat the food you take cook. It's like food. I will not eat your food. I will not eat the food that you cook. I want my own food, my own terms, my own kitchen.
Yeah.
And this homogenization takes away that. So this one of the reasons that I keep saying that monotheism and homogenization are very dangerous ideas. I mean, they're not dangerous ideas. They're just ideas, but there are always alternatives. Remember, the Jewish and the Christians and the Muslims have the same God. They keep saying, but they keep killing each other. They have been killing each other forever with all the technology in the world. Israel still treats Palestine like horrible people. The Muslim world treats Israel so badly. The Christians and the Muslims keep fighting forever. They've been fighting. And Hindus are no different. We are still casteist as ever. Recently, the IIT Kharagpur. We are not changed. I mean, that does.
It's a core human tendency to find differences.
It's good to be dominating. That is why we invented robos. Robos means slavery. The word robo comes from slave. It's the East European word.
Eastern
word for slave.
Oh.
So when you say, I want a robo, what you're saying is, I want a slave.
Wow.
That is why we like Harry Potter. I'll just move my wand and whatever I want will happen. So I can create the perfect girlfriend who will obey me 24/7.
There is a theory of how if there are two tribes, then the tribes will fight against each other. If there is one tribe, the families will fight against each other. If there's only one family, the brothers will fight against each other.
And worst case scenario, you'll get schizophrenia and fight with each other.
It is part of human tendency to want to keep. So this is the irony, sir, that in situations, we will collaborate with the unlikeliest of people. And we will come together in the most amazing of ways. And we say, look, that is humanity. But in the other situations, we will fight with the people who are closest to us. And we say, look, that is humanity.
So collaboration and competition is always going to be there in nature. You will, it's not going to change. This is the funny thing is the amygdala is still there.
Yeah.
Lower brain is still there, and the higher brain amplifies the horrors of your animal brain and also
the good things.
It gives you both. It tells you, I will amplify the horror. So imagination amplifies your hunger. Imagination also gives you solutions to your hunger. Imagination also gives you sensitivity to other people's hunger.
Yeah. Empathy, yeah.
Imagination also tells you how to control other people. So imagination gives you so many other things that animals don't have. We will, so our hunger is greater than animal hunger because animal does not imagine hunger of his children and his children's children and his children's children. Here, with all the wealth in his disposal, Bill Gates, India will steal the patent.
So his prefrontal cortex is amplifying what his amygdala is afraid of.
Yeah. So for all the wealth, it's a great case study that the richest man in the world is so scared. And of course, if you ask him, he'll say no, and he'll give you this very complicated logical reason. And in Hindi, we will just say that, you know, we can't say it in, of course, but kyun bana raha hai mereko?
One thing that I thought of in favor of religion was that just like we cannot judge what gods the people of Alaska are praying to, similarly, at the time and place when these religions came into existence, there is a lot to be said in favor of how religion probably kept everyone sane, gave them a sense of purpose, gave them an explanation when there was no other explanation. And probably without it, people would have gone mad. People would have, lost their hope.
Activism needs oppression, right? If there is no oppression, an activist will go mad.
Yeah.
Although he sees the irony of it, he's fighting to get rid of oppression. But in the absence of oppression, what does he do?
His identity will not be an activist anymore.
Yeah. So you need problems to solve, and you solve so that you feel alive.
Yeah.
So hunger reminds you that you are alive. Yeah. If you didn't have hunger, you are a rock. So we coming back to the, you know, the Ghoom Phir Ke, your hunger reminds you are alive.
Yeah.
Your fear reminds you are alive. If you didn't experience hunger and fear, you wouldn't be alive. So life is hunger and fear, and dealing with hunger and fear, and it won't change even when you have as much money as Bill Gates.
Yeah, this is a good reminder. Sir, there is a super chat that has just come in asking you about free will and your opinion on it.
See, free will is an idea. Nobody in Hindu traditions will talk about it. Where does this conversation of free will come from? It comes from the Catholic Church. All religions which spoke of conversion will speak of free will. Religions that don't speak of conversion don't speak of free will or choice. Because there is this constant need to convert. If I want to convert you, I need you to have free will. And this is where this concept of free will, because who talks about free will? Let's go to the history of free will. Free will conversations have only happened in spaces where people have been trying to market an idea. So now suddenly free will, choice. And now there'll be the opposite saying that there is no choice in the world. Free will is an illusion. The fact is, when I go to the buffet table, I can choose whether to eat this or whether to that. For me, that's free will.
Yeah.
But then somebody said it's manufactured choice.
Mm.
Because you have been manufactured. Hey, this whole conversation is Christian. It began with Christianity. Before Christianity, nobody asked this question. Nobody asked this question. Why? Who raised this question of free will? Let's ask, find out the philosopher who spoke of free will, find out which historical period he belonged to. And why has Adi Shankaracharya never spoken about it? Why Vallabhacharya has never spoken about it? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has never spoken about it? These were intelligent people. Chanakya doesn't speak about it. Manu doesn't speak about it. Udaya Bharati doesn't speak about it. How come Indian philosophy has no reference to this? Because it is not an Indian concern. This whole idea of free will comes from tribal societies.
Right.
Because in tribal societies, God has given you this rule and you have to follow this rule. So if you don't, you'll say, but God has told me to follow. No, but you have your own free will. So anybody who challenges tribal society will talk of free will. Indian society mein aisa nahi baat karte hum log. Abhi choice, choice, consent, consent aaya hai.
Choice तो है भगवत गीता में तो choice तो बहुत बात कर मतलब दे
this is when you see भगवत गीता translations become popular in the 20th early 20th century. We are under the influence. See, Vivekanand was educated by Christian missionaries. He was very good in English because he was taught by English professors. So he is now trying to explain Hinduism using Christianity as the benchmark. So what are the big words in Christianity? Free will. So now he looks at Bhagavad Gita with free will. He's not, Bhagavad Gita never talks of free will.
Achha.
Bhagavad Gita is telling you decision le. To bhagna, it's very simple. Why do you want to fight? No, I can't fight. Why can't you fight? No, I can't kill my relatives. So basically, if your relatives can't be killed, if they were not your relatives, you would kill them. That is okay. The problem is not that I don't want to fight, which people keep saying. I'm like, Bhagavad Gita ka problem is not that Arjun doesn't want to fight. He's telling, main apne relatives ko nahi manunga.
Exactly.
But please go and read half the textbooks which are written on Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
And tell me how many of them raise this one point. His problem is not with murdering people. He is okay murdering people. He is trained to be a killer.
Yeah. His conflict is family.
Family. Because I am a Kshatriya, I have to take care of my family. How can I kill my family? He has been killing people all his life.
Okay.
That's what soldiers do. You're trained to kill. So suddenly a violence ki baat nahi aayi hai. This is about how can I kill my family.
Right.
And Krishna is saying, bhaiya, the whole world is my family. If the whole world is my family, then khayega kya? Because the fish that you ate is your brother. The mutton that you eat is your sister. The trees that you cut are your cousins. So
yeah, when I read Gita, my understanding was that this idea of this concept of questioning about choice and free will is a blind end. It's a blind alley because it doesn't lead anywhere.
No, see, these are questions that emerge while you are raising this question, and I understand you are raising this question as a person. It has been planted in you by a very Western world that we are
part of. But even when I talk about it from a neuros... Huh.
These are Chinmaya mission questions.
Okay.
The missionaries, they were trying to... When the mission comes in, you will have free will and choice. What is a missionary trying to convert you? Whether it is any mission, do you see the word mission? I am in a mission to convert you. Then I will say, you have free will. You have choice.
Wow.
And when, the moment I want to convert you, you will talk of free will.
Okay. Outside of the realm of conversion, even when I think about it from a neuroscience perspective of consciousness, or what is consciousness, or what is decision making. From that perspective, also, I found it interesting that when a decision is made in the brain, there are parts of the brain that makes the decision a few milliseconds before you are aware that the decision is made. So from that perspective, I found it interesting that we can talk about free. When we say, did I do this or did a part of my brain do this? But it is you. Maybe you are not fully aware of all parts of your brain, but that is a different discussion.
From this point of view, you don't exist. So if you talk to Buddha, then if you go it from a Shankaracharya's point of view, Atma is taking all the decisions. So these are
right questions. Right, right.
At the
right.
end of the day, if you are not taking the decision and Atma is taking the decision, then let's go and eat mutton biryani. Because Atma has decided, if Atma has created mutton biryani, then everybody should eat mutton biryani. Go and tell that to a vegetarian.
Right, sir. So the part of the super chat that I missed was also about Advaitya. And your opinion on that, is it the crown jewel of Indian philosophy?
Yeah. Let me be very clear. This is very popular among Hindutva activists because Advaita is very similar to monotheism. So in, again, 19th century, suddenly it's called Neo-Vedantic. Neo-Vedantic thinking is a very 20th century phenomena. You know, Arya Samaj, Vivekananda, all of them were trying to define Hinduism, and we want to make Hinduism uniform, and therefore we have decided Advaita. Please understand that Shankaracharya was a Brahmachari. He did not believe in temple worship. He saw temple worship as Maya. So he didn't believe in Tirupati Balaji or Nath Dwara or Kumbh Mela. He was a crypto Buddhist. He was following Nirguna Brahman, was for him Shunya. So these are ideas which were there. He did not like temple rituals. Adi Shankaracharya comes from the 8th century. In the 8th century, India did not have these big temples that you see today, that you are seeing today in front of your eyes. These temples were built much after the 8th century. He lived in the 8th century. At that time, he lives in Kerala. You know, everybody tells me that, you know, he lived in Kerala. I said, which language did he speak? And everybody tells me Malayalam. I said, Malayalam was only started being spoken in the 13th century. So in 8th century, Adi Shankaracharya would never have spoken.
I didn't know that.
Little detail, which everybody forgets. That 8th century, nobody on earth spoke Malayalam.
So then he would speak Sanskrit? Or what is he?
He would have definitely spoken Sanskrit because he came from a Nambudri family. But right. He would have spoken Proto-Tamil. Some kind of old form of Tamil. Kulasekara Alvar was at that time. Alvar poetry was being composed at that time. Nayanar poetry was being composed at that time. He would have been exposed to, and that is the early forms of Bhakti poetry. And as far as he is at a different world. This Advaita is basically, why is it a concern for us? Because we are trying to uniformize, homogenize Hinduism, trying to create our version of monotheism. Advaita sounds, there's no difference. There's no practical relevance at all. Ramanuja would have rejected it completely. Because Ramanuja realized that temple worship is very important to Indians.
Yeah.
And he creates something called Vishishta Advaita, and he says, Archamurti, ultimately puja. Is important, and only Archamurti is the temple. So if it is only the temple deity, so Jagannath Puri is very different from Srirangam temple.
Yeah.
How will you explain this? Advaita is everything is one and all, but I'll be vegetarian. If Advaita is everything, then eat non-vegetarian food and show it to me.
So this idea of how, just like, again, we keep coming back to the igloo, which is a very useful example, that everywhere, if you look at the temple or whichever place of worship, that becomes a very important part of your immediate social fabric. So you cannot sit in Rajasthan and say that why are people in Kerala praying to this particular structure. It is the way that environment is there.
Yes. And you see, what we are trying to do is trying to create these Hinduism with Advaita, Dvaita and all that. You know, because we are trying to homogenize it, and this yearning to homogenize Hinduism, you see it in Vivekananda's book in the early 20th century, but that he lived under the British rule. He died in like 120 years ago. He is not aware of feminism. He is not aware of gay rights. He is not aware of equality. He is not aware of Black Rights Matters. He is not aware of all the issues that you and I are exposed to. So he doesn't talk about it. Does he talk about women's rights? Does he talk about rights? Does he talk about human rights? Does he talk? He's not. He's not even aware of Swarajya. He's not aware of independence movement.
Right.
He doesn't understand these concepts because he lived in the 19th century.
Yeah. He talked about things that are there at that time.
What mattered to him? And he is very interested by Advaita. Remember, his Guruji, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, was a Bhakta Yogi. And Advaita Shankaracharya did not like Bhakti at all. He saw it as Maya. Bhakti is not part of Adi Shankaracharya, is very clear in Jnana Yogi, but Ramakrishna was about love, was about Kali Puja, was very clearly involved in temple worship in his village, in his day form, and he genuinely believed in Bhakti.
Yeah.
So Vivekananda does not agree with his Guruji. Vivekananda's thinking is very westernized. He is impressing the Western world. He is not. Ramakrishna is completely Bengali tantric Shama Shongit. And these are very different, complete conversations that are happening. He doesn't talk of Jagannath. So why does he not talk of Jagannath? Where if he's from, because he's a different world. He is like today's Gurujis, very famous, talking to an upper class elite audience in English, very articulate, very impressive. And he's trying to make it, Indian national movement is emerging at that time. So he's trying to create an Indian language.
It's interesting. it's interesting that even for a spiritual leader, the question of hunger comes, because the way you see your spirituality depends on who you are talking to or what you want.
It is always that. The fact is, why did Vivekananda's function is a function of his context. You have to see which ecosystem, what geography he lived in, what history did he live in, yeah. What kind of people was he exposed to, how did he change the discourse before him and after him, how have ideas changed. You should not see him as this, trying to turn him into Jesus or trying to turn him into Muhammad is a very monotheistic way of thinking. Like Jesus lived 2000 years ago, Muhammad lived 1400 years ago. The different needs of those times, very good ideas perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to genuinely be a scholar and understand these things, you have to see it in context.
So because, I love, sorry sir, continue.
No, it's that. It's the whole idea of not seeing things in context.
Yeah, I love the idea of contextual truth, because we pick up a textbook. For example, if I pick up a neurology textbook written 60 years ago, I cannot say that this person has talked about tuberculosis in such a stupid way. I have to give context to the idea of what was known at the time. Were there microscopes? Did he have access to information?
Absolutely.
And then be admiring of the fact that us time mein isne itna kaam kaise kiya.
Exactly. So you know that, you know, in the Shushruta, they talk of diabetes. Because through observation, they realize that some people's urine is so sweet that ants go towards it.
Right.
Did they know about blood sugar? No, they didn't. But yeah, they were sensitive enough to recognize the presence of something sweet in the urine happens in some people, and therefore that's a problem that needs to be handled.
Yeah. So for me, a lot of these religious contexts are impressive in that sense, that at that time they could understand that your brain needs to be controlled and you cannot just let...
And see, the monotheistic religions try to homogenize, want to make their religion outside context.
And so can you repeat that again?
So you are trying to say that what applies in Islam, say in the 7th century AD, should apply in the 21st century. Jesus lived 2000 years ago. He was not even aware that the church is going to be created. He just said some, you know, if you read the Gospels, there are 20, 30 lines that he says, and that's it. He's talking about it in the context of original sin and God. He is living in Israel. He's talking about his ecosystem. He's not talking about the whole world. He's never talked of. He said, go and tell people that, you know, there is a heaven after you die, there is a heaven, and blessed are the meek, and God, there's a better life after death. These are the ideas that he promotes. And now in the 21st century, we have other ideas to look at.
Yeah.
While that has been going to be bearing on you, we give it too much of importance. We have to look at the 21st century. So you can't look at Ramanuja's idea and apply it today, and you can't apply it to Adi Shankaracharya's idea. He lived in the 8th century. He gave a set of ideas which are very useful to live my life, but they are one of the many inputs that I have in my life. It can't be the overwhelming supreme idea that ever came down, because he lived a different life. Remember, he was celibate. He did not listen to his mother. He, you know, and if you don't listen to your mother, you usually have a lot of problems. So, and he challenged the status quo at that time. He was told not to cremate his mother, and he still cremated his mother. So whatever little we know of his story. By the way, the stories of Adi Shankaracharya come to us only 500 years after he died. So we don't know whether they're true or not.
Right. The one with the crocodile? No. Is that
all
the same?
Yeah. The Shankara Digvijayam comes from the 13th century, which is 500 years after Shankaracharya. So how much value are you going to place on it? You know, it's like in Islam, the Hadith, which is talks about the life of Muhammad, was recomposed 100 years after the Prophet died. So how much of it will you value? Which will you value? There's still now the vibes going on, which is real Hadith, which is not. So,
like all stories, it becomes like a Chinese whispers kind of a thing, that people, there will be context applied with every retelling of the story.
You know, in the case of Hadith, the interesting thing is more details are available. The further you go away from Muhammad's lifetime, the more detailed stories you get.
Right.
The closer you go to Muhammad's lifetime, you find less detailed stories, which tells you that certainty comes as you move away from fact.
Wow. So can you just repeat that again? I love that line. Oh my God, that is so true.
Yeah, so you see, certainty is the more you go away from fact, the more certain you are. So whenever you see all the people are very certain of their truth, I'm like, hey, to gadha hai, complete stupid fellow, because no scientist on earth is ever certain of the things he measures.
Oh my God.
Who have never studied anything, never gone to school, never gone to college, never experienced things, but are so sure.
Yeah.
Are like they know everything about coronavirus, they know everything about vaccines without
Because,
even passing their school exams.
sir, I remember in my MBBS final, I was so much more certain of my diagnosis than after my DM neurology.
Because you are like, okay, maybe you're always working with so many variables. But theek hai na, certainty is a function of stupidity and distance from facts.
Wow.
Anyway, we'll have to.
Yes, sir. So I think I have 100 more questions for you, but I don't want to keep you for too long. I think I've already taken up 1.5 hours of your time. If you agree, sir, I would love to have you on at some point in the future.
Yeah, sure, we'll do that. We'll take a topic and then
Yes. I'll just quickly see if there are any super chats that I have missed. I don't want to. Okay, XRDI, hyper insightful chat said, huge fan of Devdutt sir. We desperately want the talk of Bhagavad Gita in virtual reality. Okay, that.
you can book my Gita for anything.
Yes, we will. Is
Yeah, Gita, please understand that I always look at all the people who write on Gita and I'm like, okay, you see, if there is certainty in their writings, then please don't trust them.
Okay. So, okay. So Aditi Patel has asked if is atheism harmful for mental health?
No,
No.
Buddhism is atheist.
Yeah, so Aditi, you can be
Buddhism is atheist, Jainism is atheist, Confucianism is atheist, Taoism is atheist.
Yeah.
So 70% of the world doesn't follow God. God. Atheism is a concept which is only popular amongst Christians, Muslims, Jewish people, and Hindus who want to be like them.
Okay. My own personal journey has been, somebody very religious and then extremely atheistic, and now I've come to this realization that everything is neuroscience, so it's okay. Including religion, everything is neuroscience. I've come to peace with it.
You have to filter everything through your brain. Ultimately,
Yes.
you have to filter everything. Ultimately, if it creates a dopamine high or a serotonin high
Yeah.
or an endorphin high or
Yeah.
an adrenaline high or a corticosteroid or whatever. So
It
that's
comes down to that. And when I read about the placebo effect and what it really does, I completely believe that faith can move mountains because it changes neurochemicals in your brain.
please understand the old mystery cults of Christianity were basically where you would enter a temple and they'll give you drugs to experience outer body things, which is
Yeah.
called shamanic rituals and all that.
Yeah.
So all of them, when you talk about Jesus Christ and all that, the
Yeah.
mystery cults were about going and taking these drugs and going into these extra sense. They thought these were magical realms. They genuinely, today we know that they're chemicals inducing.
Right.
When you talk about soma, soma is ephedra.
Yeah.
Just nothing else than ephedra. What is Adderall? Adderall or
Yeah,
Adderall?
I don't know.
That is a upper. It just gives you, helps you
Gives you a
concentrate,
high.
gives you a high, keeps you awake, makes you work hard with Indra love. That's just Homa, which is there, found in the mountains of Munjawat, which is really in the Central Asian northern part of Afghanistan.
It's just marketing done right.
People make it all exotic, ye magical realm hai and all that. It's like, sorry, buddy.
Amazing, amazing. Sir, thank you so much. Guys, please like the chat. Please make sure that you are you follow sir on Instagram. You tell him how much you enjoyed this conversation because hopefully he will come back for another discussion sometime. And follow us both on Instagram and just ask me any questions. I'll make a note of it and I'll prepare the next podcast questions.
If you have time, you could just take bits of this clip and put them on Instagram.
Definitely, sir. I'll be doing that. In the next 2, 3 weeks, I'll keep putting one every few days. Done. So 1 second. Do you find it seems all religion is an attempt to solve a genuine existential question? After studying many of these corrupted over time, do you find your own truth, Kuldeep? You don't find your own truth, sir.
Nobody does. Life just goes on and Corona hits you and then you go.
Wow. At some point, I think we have to just take a deep breath and be okay with not knowing. Because it's the panic of knowing that makes us do stupid things.
And not being terrified of death, it's okay.
All right. On
Just
that cheerful note, two doctors are signing off on that cheerful note. Sir, thank you so much, sir. Just, sir, आप रुक जाइए. I'll just close the stream and then I'll just say thank you once again. All right, chat. Thank you, everyone. I will see you all soon. Bye.